Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the News Gazette for Monday, June 29th, 2026. I'm going to start today on the front page and we'll be reading some local and national news, and then in the second half I'll cover sports and obituaries and any other good things we can find in the paper here today. The front page of the News Gazette has a main feature story on the aftermath of the storms, and the headline here is Bouncing Back. And I think this is focusing on Charleston, and it, with the subhead reads, Residents Determined to Get City Back on Its Feet, and this is by Jennifer Bailey. And I'll begin. Melania Morrison and Riley Schrader's summer jobs transformed last week in the blink of an eye. The two first-time lifeguards at Charleston's Rotary Community Aquatic Center can now be better described as a cleanup crew, and they and their co-workers clean out pool gutters, power wash the decks, and remove debris from an EF2 tornado that tore an almost 14-mile path of destruction through the northern part of the Mattoon-Charleston area on June 17th. "It's definitely a lot different from what we thought we'd be doing," Schrader said. Morrison, 16, said that when the tornado hit, she was away at church camp without access to her phone, so she didn't see the damage until she got back. Their boss, Charleston Parks and Recreation Director Diane Ratliff, said her home near the Lincoln Log Cabin State Historic Site in nearby Lerna was similarly not affected. "My house was pretty mellow compared to here," Ratliff said, "but coming into town that night, it was hard to find a road that wasn't blocked by trees or debris to get to City Hall." All city officials met and started a game plan within 15 minutes after the storm left the area. Ratliff said when she got closer to the aquatic center, she noticed there were no umbrellas where there should be plenty, and there was no direct access because of all the debris on the roads. Ratliff, who has been director for 5 years and with the department for 25 years, said she's never seen damage to this extent at any of the district's facilities. As a result, the regular summer pool season has been put on hold. "Our staff have been extremely helpful," she added. She's been trying to get lifeguards like Morrison and Schrader as many hours as possible doing cleanup and has been working with the city to make sure they are safe in the process. Each day, about 10 to 12 of the Aquatic Center's staff of about 40 are on hand at the Aquatic Center and City Parks. At the Aquatic Center, that work included recovering most everything that had been on the decks that was blown into the pools, such as chairs and umbrellas, as well as draining the pools to remove all other debris, which included parts of the roofs of the center and the neighboring middle school. All the pool umbrellas were eventually recovered. One was in the ground, one remained on the deck, and the others had been blown outside the fence. Ratliff said they're now waiting on engineering and insurance assessments on the damage. She said they can't really move forward until that gets taken care of and hopes it will happen in the near future. In the meantime, she said she was contacted by officials at Mattoon's Lytle Pool, who let her know that pass holders for the Aquatic Center could use their facility. "The community has been wonderful," Ratliff said. "Again, working with the entire city, we had a lot of community food, drive-through donations. A lot of donations were accepted by the city. A lot of individual community members were just out in full force helping them clean up and still are. The community has been wonderful. All in all, we're very thankful as a community that no one was injured and that most homes in town are still habitable," she said. "There were only a few that were not able to be lived in after this, even with their damages. We're very fortunate in that aspect." And the story kind of goes on here with a new subsection. Illinois is experiencing a record number of tornadoes this year. The National Weather Service reported that the line of storms that rolled through east central Illinois on June 17th spawned at least 7 of them. The Weather Service classified the Charleston-Mattoon tornado as an EF2 with peak wind speeds of 116 miles per hour and said it touched down about 4 miles north of Mattoon and tracked southeast for 13.83 miles before lifting about 2 miles east of Charleston along Illinois 16. "A lot of cleanup remains, but the community is strong and united in its support to return to normal." Charleston Deputy City Manager Steve Bennett said the city has transitioned from a response to a recovery phase. Our primary focus is on the removal of storm-related tree and limb debris from public boulevards, a process that will require a significant amount of time and resources, he said. He added that in addition to the city's public works crews and assistance from neighboring communities, the city has contracted with a debris removal company that is using large grapple trucks to collect tree debris from roads and take it to the city's leaf and limb drop-off site west of the fairgrounds to be mulched. He said the total amount of debris taken to the drop-off site so far is probably only about 30% of what still needs to be picked up. We've also received valuable personnel and equipment assistance from the cities of Mattoon, Effingham, and Champaign, which has greatly enhanced our recovery efforts, Bennett said. The Coles County Emergency Management Agency is coordinating a community resource center to provide residents residents access to a variety of recovery-related services and assistance programs. The city will continue to keep residents informed by regularly posting updates, resources, and recovery information on its website and social media. And then shifting a little bit here to Eastern Illinois University, EIU also has been part of the cleanup effort. University officials said the college stands strong alongside our neighbors as we navigate the impact of the tornado and recent storms. Luckily, impact to campus was largely limited to landscape loss and infrastructure strain, including fallen trees and limbs, temporary power, and associated network outages, said Josh Reinhardt, public information coordinator with EIU. EIU remained closed the day after the storm for safety and to assess damage to the campus, which also allowed it to act swiftly to help neighbors in need. EIU students and employees joined local and regional partners in mobilizing volunteers to assist with community recovery efforts, Reinhardt said, adding that its Dudna Fine Arts Center became a food and relief supply distribution hub for impacted residents thanks to donations from regional businesses and neighbors. EIU also organized volunteers to deliver essential food and supplies to displaced residents and is providing temporary housing for affected residents. In addition, EIU's athletic teams volunteered to clear limbs and debris across the community, and the university will continue to assist. Officials are coordinating with community partners, nonprofits, and government agencies to create a disaster relief resource center. The EIU community is incredibly proud of the resilience and dedication shown by our students, employees, and neighbors, and we will continue to coordinate with city officials to navigate ongoing recovery efforts and to build an even stronger Charleston, officials said. And this story has several pictures of damage of buildings and trucks and down trees and lots of cleanup efforts. I'm going to continue with some of the features that are new to the News Gazette here this morning. And the first one is the Mad About Movies column by Richard J. Lasoski. This is marking Mel Brooks' 100th birthday with Young Frankenstein at the Virginia Theater. Mel Brooks had one of his earliest comedy successes as the 2,000-year-old man, a crotchety witness to history interviewed by straight man Carl Reiner, and it looks like Brooks must be setting his sights on becoming the real thing. He turns 100, Sunday, which was yesterday, and you can share in the celebrations by taking in his favorite film, 1974's Young Frankenstein, as part of the News Gazette film series at the Virginia Theater at 2 p.m., yesterday. Young Frankenstein, you can still look it up maybe on your own home streaming service. Young Frankenstein is an affectionate spoof of the 1930s Universal horror films that mixes bizarre comedy with sincere emotional content and generally appeals to viewers of all ages, even if they're not familiar with the films being spoofed. When brilliant young scientist neurosurgeon Frederick Frankenstein, played by Gene Wilder, inherits the ancestral castle in Transylvania, he finds that it comes staffed with hunchbacked lackey Igor, played by Marty Feldman, whose grandfather had worked for his grandfather, naive lab assistant Inga, which is Terry Garr's role, and creepy housekeeper Frau Blücher, who's Cloris Leachman. whose very name sets nearby horses to winning and rearing. On his first night in the castle, Frederick discovers his grandfather's laboratory and notes on his experiments. Soon, he's trying his own hand at reanimating dead tissue, and yet another monster is lumbering through the village streets. But this time, Frederick uses a bit of vaudeville and a risky organic transfer procedure to give the monster, who played by Peter Boyle, a chance to fit into human society. That is, he would, if only his manipulative fiancée, Elizabeth, played by Madeline Kahn, and the local police inspector, Kenneth Mars, would leave him alone. Anyway, I'll leave it at that for the preview of Young Frankenstein, which was, well, yesterday at the Virginia Theater, but it's not too late to honor Mel Brooks' 100th birthday. We also have a new column by Jim Dye with the headline, he's our opinions editor of the News Gazette, with the headline, "Bears Bear Down Bears, They're Huddling in a Legislative Back Room." And I'll get started here. "The Bears are moving to Indiana. Count on it. It's happening. Then again, maybe not." A couple weeks ago, Hammond, Indiana Mayor Thomas McDermott was taking a victory lap as he contemplated the glory the Bears, a historic NFL franchise, would bring his community. Referring to a statement from Bears management that the team had turned away from Illinois toward Indiana, McDermott suggested that it was a done deal. I know why it was vague. I can't talk about that right now, but the Bears are coming to Hammond, Indiana, okay? I want you to know that," he said. That could turn out to be true. Then again, Democrats who suggested Hillary Clinton had the 2016 presidential election in the bag were just as confident as Hammond's mayor. But there are potential complications for the Hoosiers to consider. Illinois' behind-the-scenes political machinery, tawdry even on a good day, is in motion. Says who? Illinois' hint-dropping Governor J.B. Pritzker. A couple weeks ago, the governor suggested he'd be more than happy to call a special legislative session to pass required legislation if Bears management and recalcitrant legislators can work out their differences, meaning how much taxpayers will be soaked to build a new stadium. This week, Pritzker cast himself as a mostly disinterested bystander, dispensing advice to Bears management about how to get a deal done. He said the Bears are reviewing two separate pieces of legislation, one passed by the Illinois House and the other by the Senate, in order to, quote, put the provisions of each of those together in a form that they think will pass. The legislative process has been compared to sausage making. The end result can be good, but the formula for doing so is distasteful to witness. That's the way it's been in Springfield since the managers of the multi-billion-dollar business known as the Bears asked Springfield for help in building a new stadium in Arlington Heights. Senate President Don Harmon said members of his body have, quote, no appetite for assisting the Bears with special legislation. Nonetheless, his body somehow passed legislation allowing either Chicago or Arlington Heights to enter into a public-private ownership agreement that would have given the team a path to build a new stadium without paying property taxes on the facility, according to news accounts. The Bears apparently don't like Illinois' property tax system any more than Joe Sixpack. Poor Joe, however, doesn't have the clout to evade them. The House bill, dubbed the Mega Projects Proposal, would have established a payment in lieu of property taxes arrangement in Arlington Heights. There's the not-so-small matter of the needed infrastructure to accommodate the stadium and promised commercial development that will surround it. The process has been complicated by a variety of factors: Illinois' weak financial standing, fears of public blowback if they bail out a multi-billion-dollar business, legislators at odds over building the new stadium in either Arlington Heights or, as proposed by Chicago's mayor, a new location in the Windy City. There are many moving parts, so many that a deal many consider inevitable, has yet to be completed. Indiana, so enthused about playing host to a second NFL team, already has given away the store to accommodate the Bears. Will Illinois and Chicago, despite promises to the contrary, follow that example? To answer that question, ask yourself another question. When was the last time a rich and powerful interest went to the governor and legislature seeking public favors and didn't get what it wanted? And we have a new It's Your Business column with the headline, Gymnastics School Continues to Grow. This is by Jana Wiersema. When the iPower School of Gymnastics opened in 2008, it was serving about 125 to 200 kids on average, said co-owner Kevin Burnside. Nearly 20 years later, the business now has about 1,200 students. We've definitely grown every year since we've been open, Burnside said, and we try really hard to keep it fresh, create programming that people are asking for, and to make changes when they're needed. In that vein, iPower plans to add about 1,400 square feet to its main facility at 215 South Staley Road to accommodate continued growth. The main building that we're doing the expansion on houses mostly our advanced level kids and our competition kids, Burnside said, and those programs have grown a lot. Additionally, iPower is also rebuilding its boys' competition program and has hired a new head coach. Burnside noted that renovations to existing offices and restrooms are also planned, as well as a pedestrian walkway on the side of the building for student drop-off. Now we have a new one on the Tolono Bank. As of June 22nd, Philo Exchange Bank's Tolono branch is now open at 411 North Long Street. Bank officials said the facility is entirely staffed by Tolono residents and offers teller operations, a drive-up lane, a 24-hour ATM, a night depository, a coin machine, and a loan department staffed by existing local loan officers. The lobby is open 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. weekdays and 9 a.m. to noon on Saturdays. Drive-up hours are 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays and 9 a.m. to noon Saturdays. And here's a new section. The Champaign Park District has introduced a Play Passport program to celebrate Parks and Recreation Month, along with the district's 115th anniversary. Passports, which provide information on local parks and amenities, can be picked up for free at the Leonard Recreation Center, the Martin Center, and the Springer Cultural Center. Throughout the month of July, kids and adults can use their passports to go on an epic adventure full of parks and recreation, parks officials said. Users complete stops listed in the passport to earn prizes, and those who complete all 15 passport stops will receive a grand prize. And more information is available at champagneparks.org/play-passport. And here we have a new section on First Busey Corp, the holding company for Busey Bank, has named Mike Daly as its chief strategy officer. Daly previously served as director of finance and business line strategy following Busey's merger with Cross First Bank in 2025. Mike has overseen multiple strategic initiatives and delivered significant results that benefit our teams, clients, and shareholders, said Amy Randolph, First Busey's chief operating officer. He was instrumental through our integration of Cross First Bank into Busey and has done a terrific job helping align our teams and businesses. Daly has over 20 years of industry experience, including serving in leadership roles at Cross First Bank Shares, Waddell & Reed Financial, and National Bank Holdings Corporation. And that's it. And I'm going to jump into Kathy's mailbag. We have a few questions. And I will start with the first here. Kathy, this is Kathy Reiser's. The first item, it starts with, the Champaign Senior Softball League started out as a Park District League about 4 decades ago. The question is, does one of the Park Districts have a Senior Softball League? And Kathy writes, the Champaign Senior Softball League started out as a Park District League about 4 decades ago, but it has been fully independent since 2019. Senior softball player Richard Kane tells me the league was affiliated with the Champaign Park District when his father, the late Dale Kane, who has one of the fields at Dodds Park dedicated to him, helped start the program at Centennial Park in the early 1980s, along with Emerson Dexter, basically laying down bases and playing softball. The games were played at Dexter Field behind Centennial High School for a while before they moved to Dodds Park. There came a time when umpires were in short supply for all the Park District's softball leagues, senior and regular, and it decided to simplify the ump's job by applying standard softball rules to all of its leagues. Thanks, but no thanks, said most of the senior players, and they went independent, bringing their own umpires and continuing to use the special rules and infield configurations that are unique to senior softball. They still use the Park District's Dodds Park fields for their games and continue to have a good working relationship with the district, according to player Harry Rakers. Longtime senior softballer Dan Hughes credits Rakers for developing the independent local league, and thanks to him, we're still playing by senior rules, Kane said. We umpire ourselves, so that's fun sometimes. Hughes said that umpiring is remarkably fair, considering that the umps themselves have a stake in the outcome of the games. Rakers says the CU League has three A division teams for players age 50 to 54. The A division players generally are younger, better, and more serious about winning, Hughes said. The B division has five teams whose members play to have fun, get some moderate exercise, and enjoy the outdoors with friends. The games last about an hour. It's the Just Don't Get Hurt League, Kane said, referring to B division competition. The competition is so friendly that players from other teams may be substituted freely when one of the teams on the field is running short. Hughes ended up pitching for both sides during Wednesday night's first game, in which Owen's Funeral Home defeated Campus Inc. 21-16, and then went on to pitch the nightcap for his own team, CASA. The minimum age for the B division is 55. About 120 people, mostly men and a few women, take part in senior softball locally. Kane said the league has two B division players who are 89 this year, eight players in their 80s, and about 40 players in their 70s. The rest of the players are in their 50s and 60s. Senior softball uses modified rules that make it easier for older players to stay safe and keep playing the game, Rakers said. Some of those modifications include use of two additional outfielders. There are two first bases, one for the runner and one for the infielder, to reduce chances of collisions. Rakers says there are also two home plates 8 feet apart for the same reason. So the runner goes to the home plate 8 feet away, and the catcher has to catch the ball and touch the regular home plate, Rakers said. And if the throw is offline, the catcher cannot tag the runner. He or she must get the ball and run over to the regular home plate. So there can never be a collision because there cannot be a tag. There are no specific equipment modifications in CU senior softball, though Rakers said most pitchers use catcher's equipment, including sometimes a face mask or shin guards. That's because pitchers are the most vulnerable to injuries from batted balls. They're 50 feet away from the batter and may not have the eyesight or reflexes they had in their younger days. The league has its share of power hitters. Rakers said the B division has a rule that if you're 65 and over, you have the option to let somebody run for you from home plate. All you have to do is hit the ball. You don't even have to run to first base. Both the A and B divisions are always looking for new players. Rakers invites anyone who might like to play in the division to contact him at 217-521-0976. Hughes, who works mostly with the B division, may be reached at danhughesmail@gmail.com. The season typically runs from late April through July. It got off to a late start this year due to a few early rainouts, and Hughes says the 2026 championship games likely will be played during the last week of July. And I'll move on to some more state news. Here we have a Capital News Illinois story with the headline, Prediction Market Kalshi Sues Illinois Over Regulatory Try. And this is by Maggie Doherty of Capital News Illinois. Prediction market Kalshi, which offers trades on everything from top goal scorers at the World Cup to winners of the reality show Love Island and the 2028 Democratic primary, sued Illinois on Tuesday over its latest push to regulate sports bets on the platform. The most recent move in the ongoing legal battle between the state and prediction market operators came after the state enacted a new sports wagering taxes to support the $55.9 billion budget it passed this spring. Illinois classifies Kalshi and other prediction markets as unlicensed sports wagering operators, offering the same bets as sports books like DraftKings and FanDuel, but without paying taxes or adhering to reporting standards. Kalshi disagrees with the state's characterization and is seeking to block the new requirements before the company becomes subject to criminal penalties for failure to comply when the law takes effect Wednesday. This action challenges the state of Illinois' clear violation of the Supremacy Clause with respect to the regulation of event contracts, Kalshi wrote in its complaint, arguing that the event contracts offered on prediction markets should be exclusively regulated by the Federal Commodities Future Trading Commission. The new taxes enacted under Senate Bill 3019 amended Illinois' Sports Wagering Act to add a 1.75% tax on the first 5 million sports wagers per fiscal year made on prediction markets and 3.5% for wagers made after. Those taxes are set to take effect next week, as is a requirement that Kalshi obtain an Illinois sports betting license. Kalshi, valued at $22 billion last month, called the licensing costly and burdensome in its complaint. The initial license fee for online and mobile sports wager operators costs $15 million and is valid for 4 years, with subsequent four-year renewals at a cost of $1 million. It also challenges the state licensing requirement that the license may only accept an entry from a person physically located in the state, requiring the use of geolocation tracking to ensure adherence to the law. Kalshi says complying with that requirement would put it in direct violation of the Federal Commission's requirement that contract markets offer nationwide and uniform access to their markets. President Donald Trump, his family, and business associates have promoted prediction markets and vowed to fight state efforts to regulate them. Anonymous gamblers have made huge bets in the unregulated prediction markets shortly before Trump announcements, profiting handsomely and raising concerns that people close to the administration could be engaging in a type of insider trading. The Federal Commission also sued Illinois earlier in April to assert its jurisdiction over prediction markets after the Illinois Gaming Board sent cease and desist letters to operators including Kalshi and Polymarket. The federal regulator argued that the sports-based event contracts the markets offer are more similar to grain futures than to sports wagers, giving it exclusive jurisdiction. The regulatory tug-of-war comes as sports wagering in the state has exploded, with Illinois residents losing nearly $1.5 billion on legal sports bets last year alone after payouts. The Kalshi suit, filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, named Governor J.B. Pritzker, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, Illinois Gaming Board Administrator Marcus Fruchner, and the four members of the Gaming Board as defendants in their official capacities. In its most recent motion, Kalshi sought emergency treatment for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction to prevent enforcement of the new law before it takes effect on Wednesday. Raoul's office said it is reviewing the complaint. The state gaming board did not respond to a request for comment from Capital News Illinois. And Capital News, and that is, I guess, the end of the story. And I have a quick crime-related story here. Urbana woman charged in drunken hit and run. An Urbana woman has been accused of hitting a 9-year-old bicyclist as well as another vehicle containing four juveniles while driving under the influence. Triciana C. Fikes, 30, has been charged with 3 counts of aggravated driving under the influence and one of leaving the scene of a crash involving an injury in the Wednesday evening incident. It began when Champaign County Sheriff's deputies responded at 6:03 p.m. to the area of Illinois Street and Dodson Drive in Northeast Urbana for a report of a hit-and-run crash. Assistant State's Attorney Joel Fletcher said a witness told deputies they saw a white Chevy Malibu hit a juvenile and another vehicle before fleeing. The witness was able to take pictures of the suspect vehicle, including the license plate. The Chevy was later located at the nearby Super Lucky Star food and liquor store. The juvenile victim, a 9-year-old girl, was near the side of the road with physical injuries when deputies arrived, Fletcher said. She said she was riding her bike when a white vehicle came up behind her, swerving, and eventually hit her. She said after it hit her, it briefly slowed down before continuing to drive, briefly cutting through a yard. The girl was taken to an area hospital to be evaluated. Officers observed scrapes and a laceration to her skin. And I'm going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for Monday, June 29th. please stay tuned.